Hello, you're listening to On the Point, the News Collective's show, formerly known as Democracy Watch, bringing you alternative and undercover current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Zachary Tharp.
I'm Akshay Kulkarni.
I'm Adeline Payne.
I'm Lauren Benson.
I'm Isa Yu. It is Thursday, March 5th at 5:10? What did I say? 5:10? Okay, 5:10 p.m. Suddenly, I don't know how to read time. We are broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
We have a packed show for you this evening. We look at a story about the Wet'suwet'en walkout and surprise blockade, the AMS elections, and a few headlines.
Adeline and Melina covered the controversial blockade organized by UBC C350 that took place yesterday at the intersection of Westbrook Mall and University Boulevard. Let's hear about what happened.
The hum of drums bled through the air across campus. I was walking from Buchanan when I saw the crowd, probably around 200 to 300 students and supporters with signs, banners, and the sort of clamor and excitement that you feel beneath the soles of your feet, the kind that shakes the ground. And that's when they began to move. They made their way from outside the nest to the intersection of Westbrook Mall and University Boulevard, where they stood, with Wet'suwet'en. Even in those four corners of that intersection, the blasting of car horns was so constant and loud, the sound felt like a dull throb. One that was met with a pulsating energy, voices that cut through cheers and claps and grew into chants.
Some drivers.
The Facebook event page for the walkout states that our academic institutions are complicit in this violent violation of Wet'suwet'en sovereignty. UBC has declined to make a statement and maintain foundation and pension investments in TC Energy and the Coastal GasLink pipeline. Thanks for listening. This piece was reported and produced by Milena Carrasco and Adeline Peng. Special thanks to the News Collective's CITR.
Hey Giselle, what are you doing March 14th?
Nothing, Oren. What are you doing?
Well, I'm glad you asked. CITR and Timber Concerts present Pale Hound.
Pale Hound? Where?
At the Fox Cabaret, with special guest, Adult Mom. Tickets are available at timberconcerts.com. Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
You're listening to On the Point at CITR 101.9 FM. You were just listening to the news poem that Milena and I made at the UBC C350 blockade on campus yesterday. It's a first on CITR, the first news poem to ever broadcast right here on the Point. So let's talk about the blockade. Basically, anyone who takes a bus that starts or ends at UBC probably noticed the delays on the bus.
Yeah, I would definitely say I was pretty frustrated at first when just trying to take the 99, and it's like, why is there a huge pack of people at the exchange and just no buses are going to and from? I took the 84 to campus. And that was fine, but when we got close to campus, I could see police cars and about six R4s just stopped right at the intersection. It's like, okay, how are people going to get around? How is this going to really impact my day? Because I'm trying to get somewhere else around the city, and I need to take the 99, but the 99 is not going anywhere because the intersection that it drives through is completely blocked off.
My disruption was sort of minimal in comparison. I had to just go to the supermarket, like Savon, which is like Westbrook Village, and I wanted to get the 68 because I'm lazy. I could have just walked because I live on campus. But so I was waiting for the 68 for like half an hour, and I was like, this is weird, this doesn't happen. And then I looked on like Twitter, and then UBC is like, we're experiencing significant disruption. And I was like, oh God, okay. But to be honest, I kind of appreciated it because I could just listen to a podcast, gave me more time, didn't have to like worry about getting on the bus with people around me and everything else. But, you know, there was quite significant disruption. I mean, I had to travel 2 kilometers, other people had to go across the city. So I can imagine the blockade wasn't really, it was a minor hassle for me. It was probably like a major, major inconvenience for anyone else.
Mm-hmm. And something that came up in a conversation between me and Zach yesterday was that we wondered if doing a blockade at like the intersection in front of UBC is necessarily the best way to go about trying to get change. Zach, do you want to add more to that?
Basically, like, talked about how, you know, this is a lot of oil executives and people, you know, I think the pipeline starts in Alberta and is working its way here. But what do university students and professors and staff really, what can they do to stop this pipeline? That is more provincial government, the prime minister, you know, Justin Trudeau, and these oil executives that most likely don't go to UBC and aren't taking the buses to get around. And also, a lot of, it kind of reminded me of the TransLink protests where they're going to start the strikes and everything, and how it's like, okay, I understand that you want people to know about like the struggles that these bus drivers are going through, but do you think the CEO of TransLink takes the bus and is really affected necessarily by delays in the bus times or a complete strike of all buses in a major metropolitan city? Probably not. He probably drives his expensive car to work and parks right next, you know, right in front of the door. Definitely doesn't take the bus. So he's, you know, he's probably not really affected by this. But people who don't really have a say in what's going on in a business, let alone a multi, you know, billion dollar pipeline, aren't really affected. Plus, or don't really know how to do this or, you know, talk to these executives. Plus, you know, some of the buses stopped are electric, so they're not even powered by oil.
I think there's a bigger discussion to be had about the value of action in general. And because many people were saying that, like, protests here are very milquetoast compared to, like, what happens, like, even in India, like, if there's a protest, like, people get really violent, they throw stones and stuff like that. I mean, I'm not advocating for violence particularly, but the value of action is in So like you mentioned that like if you stop the buses running, the CEO of TransLink isn't probably going to get affected. And the thing is, you can't really affect his bottom line directly unless, you know, you take drastic action and become violent. And I think the value of action in this context, going back to yesterday, was to make people aware. Because I think a lot of people who go to this university who aren't, you know, journalistically inclined or who aren't studying like politics or anything like that would even know about what's happening with the Wet'suwet'en blockade, what's happening, what the RCMP has done. So I think the argument would be is that how are we going to get attention? Because no one reads the newspaper anymore. No one listens to the radio. I mean, people, I hope you're listening now, but like no one's listening to the radio. And like, you know, many people aren't aware. So if this is the only way to bring attention to these causes, which I would argue are in need of attention more than anything else right now, what else can you do, right? And it's the same thing with TransLink.
I think possibly there's also a difference in intent for TransLink. The approach they did was like would cause TransLink to lose money, from what I understood, for the days when they were striking and there was no service. TransLink would have been losing money. And so there was an incentive, like there was more of a push, whereas I think for the Wet'suwet'en the blockades, it's possible that like we would have to talk to the organizers, but like they're not really open to media stuff right now as of like last time we reached out to them. But I think there is the possibility, like Akshay said, them trying to garner more attention for the issue, because I doubt they think that they're actually hurting the oil industry either. Like, I really do think it is about trying to have that attention and have that media spotlight.
Mm-hmm. And on that, I thought, actually, you brought up some good points about raising awareness. Because, like, I do think there are a lot of students on campus who genuinely don't know what's happening, or maybe they didn't know until now. Because, like, I live on campus, and even on my floor, I was sitting in my floor lounge and brought up the topic of it and just wanted to have a conversation about it. And I was surprised that a lot of people hadn't heard about it. So whether this was the right way to go about it or not, the awareness definitely needs to be raised. And I'm not sure how you would do that necessarily otherwise.
Like the awareness, I guess, it's kind of like it can be like a double-edged sword where you'll get the awareness, but for people who don't know about the Wet'suwet'en protests, and the first thing they hear the first time they find out about it is because all their buses are stopped and they're late, or it's like, oh, I missed half of work, or, you know, I was late to an apartment viewing, which I was trying to do, and that was a bit of a stressful situation. And if that's the first thing that you hear about this event, you're going to be even less inclined to ever want to do anything, because you only have a negative
association
with what's going on. I feel like their intentions were good, but sometimes the actions can become very negative. I remember you were researching for Extinction Rebellion in Europe. They had a big protest against the amount of CO2 that the UK was producing, or especially London. And in their protest was they chained themselves to the London Underground trains, which stopped hundreds of commuters, really thousands, from getting to work. And reality, those trains are very efficient, very eco-friendly. And if everyone took public transit, we wouldn't really have a problem. But stopping these people who are trying to do the most environmentally active thing and preventing them from doing that, but not really harming people who already drive and stuff, it's just like the people that would be most likely to want to help you now can be more frustrated and really don't want to help you because they've already been negatively affected by these protests.
I would completely agree. And I don't know, because the thing is, we're so denuded of power, right? Like, what am I to do if I want to get attention to my cause, right? Like, there are only so many things you can do apart from really violent action, which I would argue is more counterproductive than any sort of peaceful action, because even if you succeed, what have you gained, right? So the value of action isn't in, like, you know, it's obviously drawing attention to the cause, but it's also about, like, think about, I mean, I know, I don't know whether there were any indigenous people at the blockade yesterday. It's probably just allies. But I would say they would argue that this is like a drop in the ocean compared to what the indigenous people of the Wet'suwet'en territories are going through. So I would say, like, highlighting systemic problems through protest, it's quite difficult otherwise. So, like, yeah. And I don't know if anyone else was sort of inconvenienced by it, but, like, I was just like, okay, whatever. I'm going to wait half an hour more, and then I can just go about my day. But, you know, I can't imagine with people with more pressing issues, it's probably more traumatic, more problematic. But I don't know. I feel like they would argue otherwise. But, yeah.
But, yeah, so now we will be taking a quick ad break, but then afterwards we have even more great stories for you.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiyam, Nisiyaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra Siyam, Nisiyam,
Nisiyaya, Anthas Yakuya, Talitin, Homasqueam, Mustail. Obedensi.
Ambulance.
Ambulance. Ambulance. Ngam ngam hong. Ambulance. AM.
Speak My Language is a collection of 5 radio documentaries centering the experiences of Chinese seniors navigating barriers in the BC healthcare system. Created through collaborations between youth and seniors, this intergenerational radio storytelling project promotes a greater awareness of language and cultural accessibility in healthcare. Come out for the launch event, Speak My Language, Celebrating Our Stories, happening at the SFU Goldcorp Center for the Arts on Saturday, March 7th from 2 to 4 p.m. The event is free, and ASL, Cantonese, and Mandarin interpretation will be provided. For more info, visit yarrowsociety.ca/speakmylanguage. That's YARROW society.ca/speakmylanguage.
You're listening to On the Point on CITR 101.9 FM. So, Adeline, you have a little thing about the BC government's tax on soft drinks. Can you explain?
Yeah, so starting July of this year, sweetened carbonated beverages, there will be like a 7% tax on those kinds of beverages. And the rationale for that is these certain beverages that are linked to obesity and diabetes, this is like an action plan to try to persuade people to choose other alternatives. And so the discussion that I was curious to start with you guys is, how much of a nudge do you think there needs to be to influence people's choices in this area?
I have one question. I don't know if they've specified, but is the tax like directly on the label, like on the grocery store label, or is it like in your bill? Because if it's the latter, then I don't think anyone would ever notice as much. You know?
So basically, this eliminates a provincial sales tax exemption for certain beverages. So this is all part of like the balanced budget.
Right.
Like in like the actual words, they only said they are slapping a 7% tax on the beverages, but they hadn't specified like the exact mode. So.
Because as far as I'm aware, if you want to make a thing which shows up on the label of the grocery store, you have to like do it federally. I'm not too sure. I might be wrong. But if that's the case, if it's actually on the grocery store labels, I think that would make more of a deterrent because then people would see that your can of Coke has gone up. But if it's not, I don't know whether even like, I think this is aimed at like teenagers because, you know, they can't buy alcohol. So the theory is that they buy a lot of soft drinks. I don't know how true that is. Personally.
It's been a while since you've been a teenager, I suppose.
It has been a while since I've been a teenager. But yeah, that's how the theory goes. So you want to wean away the teenagers and, you know, younger people from buying soft drinks. I don't know whether if it's just in your bill, they would care as much.
Okay. I hate the way I'm about to sound, but I want to say like soft drinks and a lot of like quote-unquote unhealthy food is more cheap and more accessible for low-income people. And so you do find a lot of, there's like a disproportionate amount of people like only having access to those kind of foods. So I do think it's not just a problem of raising taxes on these foods because you're just like taking away what they have access to. I think it's like if you really, really care about people, and then it would take like having to work in with companies or like have companies pay the price instead of having the consumers pay for it, because it makes it into an individual pursuit and an individual responsibility versus recognizing that it's systemic and like it's corporate.
Mm-hmm. And I think while there is some merit in this idea, I also think like at least in Vancouver, in a city where we try, where so many people try to be healthy and are really conscious of that, I think the people that are already like caring about their health already don't drink pop or soft drinks or anything like that. And I think that the people who already are making those efforts aren't going to be affected by it. And people who do drink pop, I don't know if that would be enough to sway them, because like it does have addictive ingredients, and I think it would be hard to cut out that much sugar if it's something you're drinking regularly. So I'm not sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's good in a sense that it would be better just I feel like having that tax on it does kind of hurt the low-income communities, and that can be a little bit difficult. But I feel like I would be okay if they raise the tax, and the money they got from the taxes from that, they could subsidize healthier foods and stuff. So to bring that price down, because, you know, I'm going to be more likely to want to go to McDonald's and get, you know, a cheeseburger and a soda than I would be, or for like a few bucks, and then rather than going to Whole Foods and getting a salad and coconut water and dropping $30 and still being hungry in 2 hours. So it's just having those subsidies, or having that tax go to like subsidies and stuff to make healthier things cheaper and more desirable because of their price, and have that eventually have healthy stuff be either equal or less than unhealthy stuff, then that would have much more lasting effects and more beneficial to everyone than having just a small tax and the people who are already healthy, as you said, Lauren, that just aren't really, just, it doesn't really affect them, but only affecting people who can barely afford to get these cheaper drinks that are obviously more unhealthy and stuff like that.
Yeah, no, I just checked actually in the, just after I spoke, and yeah, it doesn't actually affect the grocery store day, but it just affects your bill at the end. So like, I don't know if anyone else will ever notice, like maybe if you buy so much Coke that like it starts adding up, but like I really don't think, if you're just buying the occasional pack every now and then, I don't know whether you'd notice the extra tax. I really don't.
Adeline, I think you have something to say.
Yeah, so those are like pretty interesting points. Since the chair of the BC Childhood Obesity Foundation has mentioned that previously BC had treated sugary drinks as a grocery item, and like he and others now view them as a luxury item. Now this is a very this is really in contrast with what you guys just mentioned about actually these drinks are less expensive than, let's say, organic pressed juice. So the view of them as a luxury item, it's in contrast with reality as it stands right now. So this is an issue going forward.
Yeah, for sure. Like, yeah. I personally don't see Coke as a luxurious thing. Do you ever see it in the movies? You know, like all the classy people, all they do is drink Pepsi. Also, we don't endorse any of these brands. They're all really bad. Don't drink them. Yes.
I think I hate to make everything about a class issue, but it very much is. And I think, again, I just want to reiterate, I do feel like a lot of times, like consumerism is pushed as a way to enact change. Like we're told if we stop buying this kind of straw and we buy a different kind of straw, or we buy these reusable water bottles, or we buy, it's still feeding into that loop of consumerism, which is a little bit different from like what we were talking about when it comes to health. But I do think like it does show a greater trend and a greater problem in our society, which, like, not to sound like a communist, but I'm just saying, like, consumerism, you know, isn't your friend. Like, that's not a very eloquent way of putting my sentence.
Stop consuming.
But yeah, like, stop. Stop it.
Just don't buy anything. Live in the woods.
No, not like that. But, yeah, neoliberalism, we hate.
No, yeah, that we do.
I mean, like, living in the woods sounds pretty good. I mean, have you tried The Water by Whistler?
The thing is, another thing, talking about like class and like natural stuff, again, I'm not going to sound eloquent at all, so hopefully not that many people are listening, but like this trend of wellness movement is very much for and by rich people or people who are upper middle class. And so I think it's unfair that now we're having this idea that like by not working out, by not having a subscription to a gym, you are unhealthy or lazy or stuff like that, because that is still actively associating. First of all, like that's like fat phobic and like really shaming and that's like awful, but also like it's not taking into account that if you are working a minimum wage job and you have so little time, like you're not going to drop $50 a month to go to the gym. And so I think the entire like wellness industry is very much, again, like a product, and it's something that's been packaged and sold to us and not necessarily, I don't know, I just think we should think more critically about this sort of thing.
And not even that, I think like the wellness trends, they like do more than just like push consumerism on you. They like tug at an emotional kind of consumerism, like this fear of, oh, am I unhealthy? Do I have to measure up to these standards? When it's an expensive trend and not attainable for everyone. So to like prey on these insecurities that just aren't attainable for a lot of people is unfortunate, I think.
So, God, that's weird. Anyway, so one thing I do want to talk about is how some things are viewed as deviant and some things aren't. So, for example, we've all talked about healthy eating as the best thing, which is, it probably is, all things considered, based on science. But at the very fact that you mentioned it, Isa, is like we push like being fat as a deviant behavior when realistically, like, I don't think anyone really cares that much about how other people look and how other people go about their lives. But the way in which the media and pop culture reinforce these narratives that healthy eating is good, which probably is that it's the way it's evolved over time is so different, because now we see as healthy if you go to the gym every day and, I don't know, go to Whole Foods every day or whatever. But previously, that wasn't really the case 20 years ago. 20 years ago, everyone was buying Coke all the time. Ads are everywhere. But like now it's like, oh, it's a luxury item. So like, I think the role in which the media and everyone else has to play in this is very clear. The way we talk about it just keeps changing.
Mm-hmm. And I think another thing is that nowadays, because like, I think a lot of products are packaged with like a social justice-y kind of like feel good tone. And, you know, it actually takes away from the movement or from the purpose. Yeah. Any other thoughts?
Yeah, it's just like, I guess it's just unfortunate that, you know, these things are, you know, priced as luxuries and stuff. I mean, they, having Coca-Cola and, you know, unhealthy things should be like, you know, not necessarily a necessity, but it's just more unfortunate that healthier options are much more expensive, even though they are better for you than unhealthy options.
And I also sound like I'm wearing a tinfoil hat, which most times I am. For everyone's in the studio.
True, they're wearing one right now. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the thing is, I do think there's also an incentive to push consumerism and like push trying to eat these calorie dense foods. And then because then you have an incentive to try and get them to shame people into trying to buy your like fitness equipment or buying your memberships. Again, I know I sound very tinfoil hatty.
So you're telling me that like Gold's Gym is actually owned by McDonald's?
No, I don't think that. But I'm just saying like, I think, I just think this is all a product of capitalism.
You would be
C word.
To your point, Zach, actually, you would be surprised how many executives on McDonald's board sits on many of these wellness food boards. And if you think about how Amazon owns Whole Foods and like, and they sell us every other thing on the planet, you know, you can see the connections forming pretty easily. I'm not drawing conspiracy lines like you see the GIFs, but you can see the lines quite easily.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is this is just all about consumerism. We're really getting away from the topic, but I do think there is something about how we are sold the idea that like buying products can reflect our identity. We're sold this idea of like if we buy a certain type of clothing or if we consume a type of product, it says something about our people, and we use these signifiers to kind of find people who we assume are like-minded. And another thing is I do think using like food as like veganism is going to come up in this topic. And I do think it's interesting how a lot of times women are more likely to be the ones being shamed for not being vegan in a lot of like online spaces. Or like, why does the onus have to be on women? Yeah, so this is just like tossing out a lot of ideas.
To bring it back to identities and soft drinks specifically, you mentioned how like social justice is used as an advertising tool. Like, I don't think, was it Kylie Jenner, Kendall Jenner?
Yeah.
They made that ad about, I think it was Pepsi.
Oh, geez.
That was the worst thing ever.
That was
but,
awful.
I mean, as I was talking about, you know, 10 years ago, how it was seen as different. Like, Coke and Pepsi, like, I don't know, even 10 years ago, they were like cool, hip, and all that sort of thing. And now it's more like they're introducing all of these like Coke Zero and we're like, oh, we're so healthy now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, it's the way it's been advertised is so much different. And I think that goes with all of this healthy food movement, which, you know.
I could kind of see that tying into both of what you and Isa are saying, where, because the original diet drink zero calorie was Tab, which was advertised towards women to be more healthy and skinny. And then, you know, it kind of ties back into what you're saying, Isa.
Mm-hmm. So I think capitalism and the patriarchy are very much tied, and I know I sound. Sorry.
You could take off your tinfoil hat, I guess.
Rude. Okay.
Yeah, taking it off yet.
But yeah. Okay, fine. We have.
So next we're going to talk about the pipelines. We kind of mentioned that earlier. And how these pipelines can be very controversial and uproot a lot of communities. In the United States, where I'm from, we had another pipeline called the Keystone XL pipeline. Yep. And that was very controversial because it went through Native American land.
Yep.
And eventually, the pipeline did leak. And it leaked in a bunch, like a million barrels of oil in some South Dakota farmland. And they said it wouldn't leak. They said it wouldn't leak, but
that's what they always
every
say.
Pipeline is just, it's not really if it'll leak, it's just when and who will it affect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I mean, bring it to a Canadian context. There was 2 days ago, I believe, there was a natural gas pipeline that leaked. I believe it was in BC, but I'm not too sure. And I mean, we can go into whether or not we need pipelines at all. I personally don't think so because I'm a firm believer in other forms of energy use. But I think the way in which we're discussing them right now in the context of Wet'suwet'en, the Wet'suwet'en blockade and everything else is very interesting because, again, bringing back to what we were talking about earlier with the UBC C350 blockade, we're talking about the so-called like disruption that all of the Wet'suwet'en activists and allies are doing across the country, rather than the root cause, which is the pipelines itself and the effects that the pipelines will have on their lands which they never ceded. God, wow, throat. Anyway, the lands which they never ceded and everything else. So, you know, like, I think there's a lot to be talked about in how we think about pipelines today, just in Canada.
Yeah, it's just a lot of these countries and stuff will say it's jobs that it creates, and that's the real big incentive is going to bring a lot of Canadian jobs, American jobs, you know, insert whatever country, building whatever pipeline jobs. But in reality, people forget it's the 21st century. The reason that makes oil so powerful and so much and so wealthy is because it's very easy to just suck up out of the ground and you don't need that many people versus jobs in the United States during the big automotive boom where you'd need so many different, you need to have people in West Virginia mining out the iron ore that would go to Pittsburgh to make the steel that would go to, you know, Indianapolis to have the steel put together and then around Chicago and then you'd all build it in Detroit and that's how you make the car. With oil, you just need luck to find a big oil pocket, and then you just need, you know, a pump to suck it out of the ground. And with these oil pipelines, you just need to have the temporary construction people to put the pipeline together, and then maybe a dozen or so to monitor it, because it's all automated. And it can go from Alberta and the tar sands down to the coast here in British Columbia and have maybe 30 people ever, like, really influence it. You don't need, you're not going to get thousands of jobs. You're not gonna, you might get hundreds, but most of them are going to be temporary, and you're only going to maybe create about 20 or 30 jobs, like permanent jobs. And that's basically what happened with the Keystone XL pipeline that was supposed to go from Canada all the way down to New Orleans on the Gulf of Mexico. And people protested that, and now we're kind of, history's kind of repeating itself here, and we'll see whether or not the mistakes of the Keystone XL pipeline and the protests that unfortunately just didn't fully work out. Maybe, you know, they have a chance here, and maybe this could be, you know, the point where it's like, this is possible. We can't stop these big oil pipelines and protect the earth and indigenous people at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And I think, like, not only can we find different ways to create, like, permanent jobs in Canada and find different solutions for energy and stuff like that, like, for me, one thing I always think about is once that oil is spilled, that's a lot harder to reverse and, like, fix than it is to create new jobs and find a different way to combat that, like, preemptively, because once it gets in the water, there's no great solution for getting it out, and our waters are already at such a crisis point right now, and so is the environment, that it just doesn't make sense to me. The pros do not outweigh the cons for me, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So, moving on.
And up next, we have an interview with Declan Rounds about the upcoming AMS elections.
Hi. Introduce yourself. What have you been working on for this campaign?
Okay. Well, I'll say straight up that it's not so much a campaign for me. So I'm the communications officer for the AMS Elections Committee. So we're a team of about six people, and we're essentially running the elections this year. So I haven't been working on much except just promoting voter turnout. That's been my main objective for elections, and that's why I'm here to speak about today.
So what positions are up for grabs?
Okay, there's a lot. Okay, so you have the AMS executives. There's five positions for that. VP admin, VP academic and university affairs, AMS president, and, oh God, I should know the rest. But yeah, there's five positions. They're all on our website. And then you also have board of governors. There's several positions up for grabs there, Senate at Large and SLFS.
Okay. Why is it important to vote in student elections?
Yeah, this is the big question. I'm a fourth-year student, and before I became a member of the Elections Committee, I'll be honest, I've never voted. That's pretty terrible, but since I joined the Elections Committee, I've been educating myself about why it is important to vote here at UBC, and one campaign I started to increase voter turnout was called hashtag your AMS vote. If you want to go on our Instagram or Facebook, there's an album with everything I did there. And essentially what I did is I talked to the archivist with AMS, and we discussed all the impactful votes that have happened under the AMS elections and how it's really shaped UBC. So previously I had no clue, but there's been a lot of referendums that have had impactful votes, like SASC, the gallery lounge upstairs that was brought about in AMS elections, a fee to build the nest that was brought about in AMS elections, the UBC, everyone loves that the campus publication that was revived in, I believe, 1995 or so, through a referendum campaign, and then obviously, there's all the impact you have through your student leaders that you elect, whether that's Senate at Large, Board of Governors. I can't speak about specific candidates who are still running because, obviously, I can't endorse candidates as an Elections Committee member, but they have made tangible impacts. If you research it, it is there. One example I can talk about last year, Christina, she was an AMS executive. She's not running again last year, hence why I can speak about her. But she helped convince the government to stop increase interest on student loans. So they have an impact for sure, and it's worth voting for them.
Have you noticed a trend in voter turnout, like, over the past few years?
Yeah. Well, I'm a one-year committee member, so it's a new thing every year. But I have inquired about voter turnout, and our voter turnout here at UBC is pretty low. It's around, I believe, 20%, 21% on average. Last year, we had about 12,500 votes. This year, we're expecting a lot lower turnout because we've banned postering. Well, AMS Council banned postering. And last year, they voted on a UPass referendum. This year, we don't really have as popular referendums, but we do have an Indigenous seat referendum. I think that's important for everyone to have their say on. But yeah, we are expecting a lower voter turnout this year, unfortunately. But yeah, if you're listening to this, go out and vote, and hopefully you can increase that.
Right. So the last day is the 8th, I think?
Is that correct? No, the last day is tomorrow.
So tomorrow, okay.
It closes at 5 p.m. tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's like 1 day left of voting, I suppose.
Pretty much, yeah.
How has the campaign been so far?
So obviously, yeah, I'm not running campaign.
Yeah, not the campaign, but the elections.
Elections, yeah. It's been pretty smooth running so far. We've had like really good engagement at the events. We're not sure how that's going to translate into voter turnout, but it's been really great to see everyone at the debates. If you haven't seen the debates, you can go on to the UBC Facebook page. They're all live streamed. They're all up there. And you can, if you're curious about what candidates you want to vote for, you can go and watch the votes, the debates there. There has been a few spicy moments, let's say, in the debates. But yeah, for the most part, it's been pretty smooth sailing.
What issues have been debated?
Okay. There are so many issues. I don't know where to touch because it varies for each position. But I would say being at the debates, the biggest issues have been Indigenous issues, actually making a difference rather than just, you know, I feel like a lot of people think that it's just another box to tick in their campaigns. There's been a lot of Indigenous committee members come to the debates and participate. That's been great to see. SkyTrain to UBC has been a big topic of talk. Obviously, the climate crisis right now has been a big topic as well. In the VP external debates, there was a lot of talk about clubs and making them more accessible, the issues around clubs. Sexual violence has been a big topic, making UBC more affordable, stopping the increase in tuition for both domestic and international students. These are all things that student leaders are trying to campaign for, and that's why they need your votes.
Right. So how do we actually vote?
Okay. Voting is literally so easy. I can't stress it. So you go onto our website, which is ams.ubc.ca/vote, and you just use your campus-wide login. You can do it on your phone. It's super easy. And you go through and you pick which candidates. You rank them in your order of preference, and that's how you vote.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all the questions we have. Thank you so much for coming in.
I will say one last incentive to go and vote is we have 2 block party tickets and $100 worth of Visa gift cards we're giving away tomorrow on our social media. So go find us on Facebook and Instagram. And if you vote, then you're entered into those competitions.
Okay, go vote.
Yeah, thank you.
Ruben in the Dark is coming to Vancouver's Imperial on March 5th to support his brand new album, Unlove. Let's get out of the city. I wanna drive into the dark. I wanna drive into the night. Tickets on sale now at mrglive.com and eventbrite.ca. I'm gonna run until the light comes back.
And we're back. Thanks for listening. Right now, you're listening to On the Point by the News Collective at CITR 101.9 FM.
Yeah, so we were just listening to, you know, the interview with Declan Rounds. Very cool guy. And he talked about, you know, how we all need to turn out for the AMS elections. Like, there's a lot of stuff at stake. Like, I mean, I don't know if anyone knows this, but I just went into like the AMS like budget, and it's like millions of dollars, and like no one ever realizes how much we can vote for in these things, and like it's pretty scary. Like,
your vote matters. Your vote
really does matter. I mean, there's a lot of discussion to be had about student government and like why people don't seem to care as much, but you guys should care. Anyone who's listening, if you're a UBC student. So yeah, please vote.
Okay.
So yeah, that was ISIU again, just speaking to with Declan Downs about the MS elections. Is everyone going to vote?
Yes, we are.
Yes. I already did. So
I actually did too. So
what a flex. Also, tomorrow is your last chance. So yes. Y'all really got to get on that.
Tomorrow by 5 p.m. Yeah. Just you probably received an email about it. Or just go to AMS.
Just go online. It's really quick. Just do it. It's not that hard.
Yeah, 5 minutes.
Come on.
So, yeah.
Really, seriously. Go do it now.
So that's our show. Thank you so much for listening. This has been On the Point by CITR News. We're here every Thursday at 5 p.m. bringing you local news. And stay tuned for more amazing programming. Up next is Heavy Content. They have great stuff, so keep listening.
Also, it's International Women's Day.
It's
kind of
funny
March
you're
8th.
Saying it, but yeah, it's kind of ironic. Any women in the room want to announce it instead? No? Okay.
International Women's Day.
March 8th.
We're taking the initiative since we were talking about patriarchy. But yeah, Sunday, March 8th, lots of cool stuff happening around town.
Yeah, International Women's Day. Woo! Bye.